Welcome back. I'm Kristen Marchand, and you're listening to Algonquin's Robin Hood, the story of how Archie Blaney became Grey Owl. Thanks to many films and newsreels made of Grey Owl in the 1930s, Archie Blaney became quite famous quite quickly. His popularity in England was phenomenal. In 1934, his second book, Pilgrims of the Wild, was published and became a bestseller. Interestingly, it told the story of how Anahario first convinced Archie to become a conservationist. Here's Lynn Stewart reading a selection from that book.
There was a good deal of soft weather that winter, and creatures of all kinds were very active. And with the new angle on wildlife which our experience with the beaver had given us, we thought it might be interesting to cultivate these others and see just how they responded. Anahario had made friends with a muskrat that frequented the waterhole and was something of a nuisance there, keeping it filled with grass and empty clamshells. He was a fat, jolly-looking fellow whom we called Falstaff on account of his paunchy look and the fact that he was always eating whenever visible, and he used to sit at the edge of the ice and demolish the morsels she put down there for him. He eventually got so tame that she could feed him by hand, and I think he watched for her at last as he would come bobbing out soon after she started down to feed him. He had a small house of mud and weeds down at the shore and had companions in there, but they could never be induced to put in an appearance. We had, besides, two squirrels who learned to come when called and would jump on us and take bits of bannock from our fingers. These two disagreed violently whenever they met, but in their dealings with us they displayed an ingratiating amiability that might or might not have been counterfeit, and was no doubt inspired by the ever-present hope of a handout. Whiskey Jacks, to the number of perhaps a dozen, attracted by this distribution of free lunches, attached themselves to the place and were always on deck, sitting around unobtrusively and motionless on convenient limbs of trees, all fluffed up and trying to look humble and dignified and indifferent, all at the same time as though any such vulgar thought as that of eating was furthest from their minds. But they had a weather eye on the door, and it had only to open when they all assumed a very wide-awake appearance, and some of them would start to whistle a little song, hardly more than a whisper, which ceased immediately when the door was closed again. There is, of course, no friendship amongst the wild folk that will stand up in the presence of food, it having on them something the effect that money has on not a few humans, and if a quantity of scraps were thrown to them, each would grab all he could and fly away with it. They were not, however, without some powers of discrimination, as, if one happened to be alone at the time, he would stroll around amongst the bits and pieces, looking for the biggest one. They, too, became very intimate, and some members of the flock would sweep down like attacking aeroplanes at anything we held out for them, and lift it as they passed. Yet others would light on extended fingers, and taking their portion, sit there for a few moments, apparently enjoying the novel sensations they experienced, or perhaps just warming their feet. At first, these birds were not distinguishable one from another, yet it could soon be noticed that some of them had a kind of personality, an individual manner or a look about them that set them apart from their fellows, so that they could be recognized quite readily. They are a light-built bird with no great strength or speed of flight, but they make up very adequately in address what they lack in force. If sufficiently hungry, they could put on a most woebegone appearance, which, while perhaps not consciously assumed, had a highly desirable effect on the observer, but which was exchanged for a very militant alertness on the appearance of anything to eat. One of them carried this wheedling proclivity to the point that, when there was any altercation over some tidbit or another, he would grovel in the snow with piteous cries and exhibit all of the symptoms of apoplexy. This always caused a commotion, and under cover of it, he worked his way towards the coveted morsel, and suddenly recovering his health would quickly seize it and decamp. Nearly all of what they took was stowed away in nooks and crannies, from where it was most industriously retrieved and hidden by the squirrels, but as these caches were in their turn consistently robbed by the whiskey jacks, things were pretty well evened up, and everybody eventually got enough. Yet, in spite of their shameless solicitation, these feathered yes-men were always engaging scalawags, and had they been human, they would have been longed in the category of those delightful rascals who can touch you for your last cigarette and make you feel that they are doing you a favor. To have killed any or all of them would have been easy enough, but the idea must have been repugnant to any thinking man. Yet, I had caught them yearly by dozens in sets intended for larger and more predatory game, where, caught by the legs, they had struggled their harmless lives out in helpless agony. And as these various creatures followed me and climbed my legs and bravely ran up my arms and hands to sit there in all confidence, peering at me so bright-eyed and intelligent, bodies vibrant with life and the joy of just being alive, the enormity of this unthinking cruelty impressed itself upon me more and more. Anaharea was very proud of having all of these creatures around the house, and they somehow gave the place a lively appearance and made us feel that we had been accepted as friends and fellow citizens by this company of furred and feathered folk. We attended to their wants quite as though we had been their custodians, which in a way we were, and at last our wild and ever-hungry family increased to the point that we were obliged to have rules and hours for them, while the beaver occupied the times in between. Yet, in spite of all these distractions, the days were often uneventful and very long. Fortunately, being both great readers, we had gone to the labor of packing in a number of magazines. They more than paid for their transportation by the pastime we got out of them, as we read and reread them to ourselves and then aloud to each other. Among these was an English periodical, which was evidently intended for readers coming under the denomination of landed gentry. We were well landed, if no gentry, and this particular publication became a favorite with us, not only on account of the fine pictures it contained, but probably also because the conditions set forth in it were so utterly at variance with our own. So we ambled around amidst its precise and excellent pronouncements, much in the manner of a man who circulates among courtiers attended in his shirt sleeves. Fits of loneliness for the great free country we had left assailed us every so often, becoming at times almost intolerable, and while under their influence we were hard put to find means to combat them. Anaharea would take her snowshoes and wander in the woods or draw cartoons of people we had known, at which she was an adept. For my part, I often scribbled in a writing pad and along the blank edges of the magazine pages or on packing paper, running commentaries on the discrepancies in some of the nature stories we had read, skeleton descriptions of well-remembered scenes, and short impressions of outstanding happenings or personalities we had met up with. By the same vicarious means, I lived over small portions of my former life and got some solace from it. Sometimes we extinguished the light, and opening the stove door wide, we would sit upon the floor before the fire, and the glow of the shifting embers threw red moving lances and shafts of crimson light out into the shadowy, darksome cabin, and made strange patterns on the walls, and discovered in them secret new recesses that we had not known were there. And these beams came shining out on the tins and pots and other homely ware, so that they gleamed like burnished copper in some old baronial hall, and turned to rich rare tapestry the hanging blanket at the door. And behind the looming earthwork at our backs, we could hear the intermittent murmur of the beaver, like subdued and distant voices from the past. The place seemed full of mystery, and we talked in whispers and watched the embers glow and fade and break and fall apart in the red and fiery cavern beneath the ferning coals. And here faces formed, and little images and imaginary objects took their place and disappeared again as though upon a stage. And the shapes of some of them brought back to mind some half-forgotten story or an incident or thought, and by them there were nearly always hung a tale. And presently, as we remembered, we recounted them while we sat within the small red circle of the firelight. Anaharea related at these times some of the innumerable exploits of Nanabijou, the conjurer, who was sometimes evil, sometimes good, at times a saint, more often a devil, a plausible rascal with a taste for the occult and having conveniently flexible notions of honesty, and who still survived in the folklore of the Iroquois, who are Anaharea's people. And in my turn, I told my tales of high adventure and hunger and feasting in the great dim forests beyond the height of land, and sometimes talked of war and old Bisco days. And in the cabin beside that little stove was brought to light much that had long lain buried in the past. And so intent did we become in our recountings, and so faithfully did we describe every act and every aspect of the actors in them, that they almost seemed to live again in the fiery amphitheater. And I think they never slipped entirely back to where they came from, but the glamour of the stories seemed to hang about the place, like they had happened there. And sometimes I wonder if the spirits of the past that we conjured up do not still gather in the old deserted cabin and tell their tales and play their parts again, while the cold moonbeams throw pale shafts of light through the crevices in the unchinked walls and filter down through the empty stovepipe hole and make not a red circle but a white one, in which perhaps they sit before a ghostly stove. Some of these chronicles I wrote down, getting a vast satisfaction out of the job, and I took at last to rolling these records up and put them carefully away. Somehow, they began to seem like old and honored traditions that would otherwise be lost. Pretty soon, there was quite a stack of them. I wrote little stories about our muskrats and squirrels and birds and would read them aloud to Anna Horeo. She did not seem to be as deeply impressed by them as I thought she should have been, but we had a lot of fun out of it, and she would tell them to the beavers afterwards. Of course, they would listen a while and then shake their heads and roll on their backs as they always did when we made a fuss of them. And that was about all the appreciation that I got. But I kept at it. I found that the English language did not have quite all the words I needed, and I was not above manufacturing the odd one. I stole freely out of the magazines, having no idea of the enormity of my offense at the time, but I was having a high old time and was beginning to be, so I was informed, something of a nuisance around the house. It occurred to me, experimentally and with no idea of seriously accomplishing anything, to take the highlights of all these aimless scribblings and try to weld them into something. I had noticed that, apart from the literary skill and carefully worded parent in them, many of the narratives we read with such interest had very little meat on the bone, so to speak, when they were dissected. I had plenty of material, and so I decided to write an article with lots of meat on it. So I commenced the welding process. This took about a week and resulted in a production about 6,000 words in length, very meaty, and in which I covered the greater part of northern Canada and touched with no light hand on nearly every incident and animal common to that region. The beaver were in it, and all our other dependents that lived out in the yard and in the lake, so I felt I had done my duty by all of them. I read it through repeatedly, each time with a more pronounced feeling of satisfaction, and made many alterations, and then rewrote it, working feverishly on it far into the night. I read it again, aloud this time to Anna Horeo, and would have read it to the beaver if I had thought they would have listened. Anna Horeo listened dutifully and patiently, and we discovered several points on which I had not made myself quite clear. I easily overcame these ambiguities by adding lengthy and precise explanations. Anna Horeo worked with me on these troublesome parts, and what one did not think of, the other did. And the two of us racked our brains by the hour thinking up any fine points we might have missed. This story was going to be true to life if it took all winter. These additions and interpolations brought this creation up into the neighborhood of 8,000 words. No mean accomplishment for a maiden effort. Anna Horeo once suggested meekly that it might be too long, but I rejected the idea with some acerbity. I had read a similar article in which the author had only been able to squeeze about 1,500 words out of his subject. I intended to fall into no such error. Thoughts and ideas could come and go, to be used or discarded at will, but the moment one was recorded, it became an acquisition. A story, once it was on paper, became a palace of dreams, the structure of which was studded with rich gems, not one of which was to be on any account removed. Any suggestion that some of these be extracted for the general good aroused a state of mind bordering on the mildly homicidal. I copied the effusion all out laboriously. I am not at all sure at this distance whether I used pen or pencil. Parceled it up with about 50 photographs intended to be used as illustrations, and made a special trip to town with it, a matter of 40 miles. I was not particularly anxious to sell it, but wanted a whole lot of people to read this stuff, And if they paid me, well, so much the better. I mailed the parcel to a wartime address in England, which country, I had always understood, was the market for such material. Gave special instructions to my agent that the serial, translation, moving picture, and book rights were to be retained in according with something I had read on the subject. And some demon of perversity caused me to specify the very exclusive publication already mentioned, which catered to the aristocracy. Such a thing as a rejection slip was quite beyond my knowledge, and having estimated by close figuring that the check would not arrive for at least a month, I started home at once, taking a few things for Christmas, which was close at hand. And as I marched along the trail in the driving snowstorm, I pondered deeply on the days to come. I had got some stuff off my chest where it had been fermenting for a long time, and somehow the writing of that manuscript had partially appeased the feeling of loneliness and homesickness that had overcome me whenever I saw, smelled, or heard anything that brought quick stabbing memories of the trails of yesterday. For now, the North was not so far away. It was in my hand, ready at my call to leap into action in the jumble of words and disconnected phrases that flowed from my pencil as I lived over again the joys and the triumphs, the struggles and the hardships that had made life so worth living, while my soul slipped back to wander once more at will in a land of wild romantic beauty and adventure that would soon, by all the signs, be gone beyond recall. Perhaps, too, a man might live by writing about it. I had the practical experience, but could I use it in this way? A feeling of kinship for all the wild that had been growing on me for years at this time seemed to have reached its culmination. My late experiences with the few creatures that were commencing to frequent the cabin had caused me to have quite a feeling of responsibility towards them. Though they had not a tithe of the appeal that a beaver possessed, they were by no means the abysmal, insensate creatures I had been wont to consider them, and they gave me a remarkable response in return for a little kindness. Lately, there had been an addition to our clientele. There was a half-grown fawn that used to feed across the lake from us. He was always alone and probably had lost his mother. I had myself killed several does close in. This little creature, lacking perhaps an education on this account, had little fear of us and would sometimes cross the lake, and coming up the water trail would pass around the cabin on his way. This was always at about the same hour, every second day or so, and we took to standing outside and waiting for him, and he would pass most unconcernedly and sometimes stopped and looked us over. He soon became quite tame, and we could move quite frequently near him while he nibbled at the poplar tops that had been collected for the beaver. He was a mighty interesting thing to have around, and his confidence, or his ignorance, or whatever it might be, was the best guarantee of safety he could have. After his arrival on the scene, I used to go far back into the woods for our meat, so that the sound of shooting and the sight and smell of slaughter would not drive him away. Yet a short year ago, I would have killed him with a club to save a bullet. Now, I no longer wished to kill. I had beaten and abused the North that now I found I loved, and could I but live without this slaughter, this unnecessary, brutalizing cruelty, I would be forever glad. A few clean kills for meat, that was the law of the wild and permissible. Perhaps this new idea that writing would provide, but I had no notion of how much a man would have to put out of this commodity. The thought of the possible unsalability of my product had never entered my head. A man may do a lot of thinking in 40 miles, and the familiar setting of the whirling snow seemed somehow to clarify my mind, and as I plodded onward, my aims began to take on shape and form. My impulsive action in springing the beaver traps I had not regretted in the light of sober reflection. They were now safe. This decision was final and unchangeable. That I could tame these animals, I was assured, nor was I wrong. Those other little beasts, the squirrels, the whiskey jacks, the muskrat, the little deer, they seemed to sense a sanctuary and trusted us, and the daily development of their confidence and the manifestations that accompanied it were an absorbing study. They were more fun alive than dead, and perhaps if I could write about them, they would provide many times over the value of their miserable little hides, beaver included, and still be there as good friends as ever. A man didn't need much of a hunting ground that way. I realized that these radical departures from my life training would require something more than the ordinary resourcefulness and physical courage of the woods to bring to a successful conclusion. But I did not know, at least so far as my newborn literary aspirations were concerned, that I was gaily disporting myself where an angel would have worn a lifebuoy. So I dreamed my dreams and builded my castles in Castile.
The following year, Archie Blaney wrote that children's book, The Adventures of Sajo and His Beaver People, that we told you about earlier. It too became a bestseller in England, largely after Blaney's publisher arranged a four-month tour that Grey Owl undertook. In his lecture and accompanying films, Archie Blaney, as Grey Owl, told his audiences about the great northern forests in Canada, often boiling his presentation down to his singular message. Remember, you belong to nature, not it to you. By late fall of 1936, Archie Blaney was back in Canada, dressed in buckskins with long braided hair and talking about his fourth book, Tales of an Empty Cabin, to crowds numbering in the thousands. His message was simple. Here's the preface to that book, Tales of an Empty Cabin, read by Kathy Chepesky.
Man, that is, civilized man, has commonly considered himself the lord of creation, and has been prone to assume that everything existing on this planet was put there for his special convenience, and that all animals, to say nothing of the subject races of his own kind, were placed on earth to be his servants. And this in spite of the fact that members of many of the backward races are often just as intelligent as he is, and are generally far superior to him physically, and that there are myriads of creatures extant, any one of which could, on even terms, as man to man, so to speak, trim him very effectively on less ground than he was born on. But a wider dissemination of knowledge of the worthwhile attributes and a growing recognition of the rights of these lesser creatures has worked in later days a somewhat sweeping change in public opinion among the more tolerant and sportsmanlike races of men, so that whereas kindness and understanding as applied to those supposed to be so far below ourselves in the scale of life would 20 years ago have excited ridicule, cruelty towards innocent, helpless animals, and the oppression and subjection of free and happy, if somewhat undeveloped peoples, are today regarded with stern disapproval. The wilderness should now no longer be considered as a playground for vandals, or a rich treasure trove to be ruthlessly exploited for the personal gain of the few, to be grabbed off by whoever happens to get there first. Man should enter the woods, not with any conquistador obsession or mighty hunter complex, neither in a spirit of braggadocio, but rather with the awe and not a little of the veneration of one who steps within the portals of some vast and ancient edifice of wondrous architecture. For many a man who considers himself the master of all he surveys would do well, when setting foot in the forest, to take off not only his hat, but his shoes too, and in not a few cases, be glad he is allowed to retain an erect position. And he might come to it at that, for the woods in time, sometimes a very short time, will make either a man or a monkey of you. I know they have humbled me, and a lifetime spent in the calm, majestic presence of the trees, a lifelong association with creatures who, deficient in the technique of deceit and vice, will never betray me, of consorting with men who sometimes forget to remember that they are God's gift to the universe, and the spending of my days in a region where the immeasurable immensity of my surroundings is ever before my eyes have, collectively, rather dwarfed my conception of my own importance in the general scheme of things. And it is reflections such as these that finally aroused in me a distaste for killing, and brought a growing feeling of kinship with those inoffensive and interesting beasts that were co-dwellers with me in this land of shadows and of silence. So that, ultimately, I laid aside my rifle and my traps, and like Paul, worked for the betterment of those whom I had so assiduously persecuted. In order to remove this idea from the realm of pipe dreams and put it on a basis of reasonable practicability, it was necessary to arouse public interest, to enlist public opinion on my side. To do this, I had first not only to show that I knew what I was talking about, but would have to demonstrate. With this end in view, and greatly because of the company these highly intelligent animals gave to me, I established a colony of beaver, and these docile and friendly creatures, faithful as well-trained dogs, attached themselves to me unconditionally, and are with me yet. Their general behavior and the remarkable mental attributes they manifested convinced me that the salvation of this useful and valuable animal, representative not only of all North American wildlife, but of the wilderness itself, was a worthwhile undertaking. And so it has proved, for with my further and more ambitious resolution to broaden my field of activity to include wildlife in general, I have found that in the beaver, with its almost human, very nearly childlike appeal, I had seized on a powerful weapon. Placed in the vanguard, the beaver constituted the thin end of the wedge. But alone I would not have long survived. I was poor, had a wife to take care of, and had now to earn a living at some new and unfamiliar trade, having myself closed the door on the only one I knew. At this point, with the practical idealism which has so marked their policy in wildlife conservation, the Canadian government, notably the National Park Service, investigated my activities, took over the project, and established me in one of the great Canadian national parks, giving me a free hand to carry on my researches without any further worry as to means. Through the medium of articles, books, and moving pictures, and later the lecture platform, some small success has attended my efforts. But the half is not yet done, nor anywhere near it, and I fear my kinsfolk, human and animal, are leaning on a reed that, if not quite broken, at least bends at times quite dangerously. As a literary man and lecturer, I would no doubt make a very good wallpaper hanger, or perhaps a ditch digger, but I am going to stay with it, and am learning all the time. Though I fully realize that all this while I have been sauntering around on holy ground, improperly dressed and with my boots on. Most aspiring authors get their punishment at the very outset. Mine, no doubt, will come later when it will hit the hardest, and I am waiting for the crash any time now. In the meantime, my paddles, or my snowshoes, depending on the time of year, my light traveling axe and my tea pail are standing in the corner where they will be handiest when I most may need them. So I cannot be caught unawares, and my greenness as a writer may serve after all as a protective coloring and will mingle well with the foliage of the forest in which I may yet have reason to wish that I had stayed. For I am often at a loss these later days. My self-imposed task at times is onerous. Nomadic instincts have to be suppressed. And I sometimes wonder if my skill and endurance are what they were, if I can travel as easily and accurately through great reaches of forest, whether known to me or not, as I once did, whether I can still paddle 40 miles a day in good water, or whether I can carry my 200 pounds and over on a portage. Perhaps the snowshoe bridles would pinch and burn my now unaccustomed feet. Evenings I gaze upon the glory of the sunset and wait to watch the rising of the moon, or see an eagle high above me flying far, and ponder on the fact that they, the sun and moon and the eagle, are free to follow their natural course as they pass me on their way to unknown destinations. In winter I stand out upon my snow-bound lake, by whose shores my beaver sleep in snug security, and feel with exultation the fury of the blizzard, revel in the harsh embrace of Keewaydin, the northwest wind, the traveling wind of the Indians, as it sweeps down from the great lone land that I never more may see, passing on to regions I cannot ever go to any more. And at times there comes a little stirring, a flutter of rebellion. But this must be and is quickly quenched. I must be true and ever faithful to my beaver people. Nonetheless, there often comes a lingering regret for the scenes of earlier days, the wild rapids down which we howled and whooped our way triumphantly, or climbed with strain and sweat and toil, beating the fierce white water at its own game. The pleasant camping grounds, the merry company of good canoemen gathered on the shore beside a lake or river, the savage battling of snowstorms, and the snug winter cabins now standing discarded, stark and empty in the lonely solitudes, scattered at random over 1,000 miles of wilderness. Some of them, these simple erections of logs that once were homes, have been engulfed, swept out of existence by the inrushing flood of settlement, and where once was peace and the immaculacy of untamed territories, only too often there now is squalor and meanness and destruction. On the site of one of them, a town has grown. So swiftly moves the conquering march of civilization. Those of later years lay back in remoter fastness where mercifully the tentacles of a greedy commerce may never crush them while yet one log remains upon another, where no clatter of alien tongues can ever outrage the solemn hush by which they are invested, as they stand there patiently and peacefully through all the slow passage of the years, and wait. In each there is a story, or many stories, of its few visitors who drifted in and drifted out again, to pass on and never more be seen, of the creatures who dwelt nearby and some that lived within it, or of the river, lake, or pond by which it stood, of the wild, mysterious country by which it lay surrounded, or perchance the legends of those who dwelt among those ancient forests in the long ago. Hunger there was, and feasting, anxiety and laughter, triumph and despair and high adventure. Each one had seen them all. Red-brown in the summer, gay with bright green moss for chinking, a resplendent glittering snow mound in the winter, each one had stood strong and staunch, robust against the power of the north. And in a way, each had seemed to live and to have a personality all its own, which was augmented with each new story or event. And some of these I will try now to record, as once I told them to Anareo, when she and I sat before the open stove door in the house of McGinnis during that unforgettable winter that now seems to be so very far away. As I write, my pen seems filled, not with ink, but with the sighing of the night wind in these forests, the gurgling of sunny watercourses, with the crash and roar of rapids, the hiss of whirling snowstorms, the crackle and the glow of open fires. And from it there sometimes flows, in strange accented rhythm, the half-forgotten folklore of a nearly vanished race. I will try with it, this pen of mine, to bring to you something of the spirit of romance, something of the grandeur and the beauty, a little of the soul of this untamed and untamable Northland. And though maybe I reach a little beyond my stature and these efforts fall far short of their high intention, even so you may find perhaps some passing interest in these stories of the people of a great frontier and in other tales of those more humble creatures that, though possessed of a consciousness more limited than that which man is gifted with, are fulfilling very adequately the purpose for which they were created, and are doing the best they can with what they have to do it with. A line of conduct that constitutes the main ingredient of success in any walk of life.
Grey Owl pointedly argued that Canada's greatest asset was her forest lands. In his latest book, he attacked the average Canadian's ignorance of his or her own country in the 1930s, saying that Canadians took greater pride in their skyscrapers on Yonge Street and the price of hogs than the wilderness that was so unique to Canada. Or as he put it, you can have those anytime, but we can't replace the natural resources we are destroying as fast as we can. And remember, this is 1936. Grey Owl pleaded with Canadians to wake up before it was too late. He argued that there was an end to what we believed had to be infinite wilderness. He simply wanted us to realize that. Despite those pleas, Grey Owl's message became as fragile as his own life. In August 1932, he and Anna Hario had a daughter, Shirley Dawn, but true to form, 4 years later, the couple went their separate ways, shortly after he returned from a very successful British book tour. Late in 1936, Archie Blaney married Yvonne Perrier from Ottawa, who traveled with him on his last British tour in 1937. It included a command performance at Buckingham Palace, followed by another three-month tour in 1938 that took him throughout North America. It was to be Grey Owl's last hurrah. At the end of that tour, Archie Blaney returned to Beaver Lodge, totally exhausted. 3 days later, he was rushed to hospital where he died, at the age of 49, on April 13th, 1938. In its obituary, the Toronto Globe and Mail called Blaney the most famous of Canadian Indians. The media on two continents bemoaned his passing. Then it all blew up. Angel Blaney told the North Bay Nugget, the daily newspaper that serves Temagami, the truth. Here's what the Nugget had to say on its front page the day Grey Owl died. It's read by Rob Filipkowski.
Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. April 13, 1938, Canadian Press. Lover of wildlife and staunch campaigner for animal conservation, Grey Owl died in Prince Albert Hospital today. The noted Canadian Indian's death came suddenly. Pneumonia, claimed the stately Grey Owl. He died here while his wife, Silver Dawn, recuperated in Grey Nuns Hospital in Regina from an operation. Silver Dawn and her young daughter, Shirley Dawn, survive. Major J.A. Wood, Riding Mountain National Park Superintendent, said Grey Owl's six-month tour of England and the United States apparently robbed him of resistance necessary to fight the disease. Tall and distinguished, Grey Owl carried his pleas on behalf of the forest animals he loved throughout Canada, United States, and across the ocean to the British Isles. Only recently, he returned from a tour of the old country, where he delivered numerous lectures. His recent seven-week tour of the British Isles was marked by the refusal of the British Broadcasting Company to allow Grey Owl to lecture against blood sports such as fox hunting. He refused to alter his address because he sincerely believed such sports were non-humane and wished to turn children's minds from them. The tour, however, brought its proud moments, especially his meeting with King George VI. The King, Grey Owl said later, was all for game conservation. And he added, I started as a poor, frightened savage on a stage in a theater in London in 1906 with Buffalo Bill, and I ended up talking to King George in Buckingham Palace. Meanwhile, next to that front-page Canadian Press wire story, in its Wednesday, April 13, 1938 edition, the North Bay Nugget also ran the following banner headline. Grey Owl death may bring suit. Temagami woman says she went through wedding form with well-known naturalist. action to establish her claim that she is the legal wife of Grey Owl, noted naturalist, who died today, is probable by Mrs. Angel Bilaney, Tamagami Indian, following Grey Owl's death in Prince Albert today. Press services list Grey Owl's survivor as his wife, Silver Dawn, and a six-year-old daughter. Mrs. Bilaney, however, claims she married Grey Owl in 1910, and that he actually was a full-blooded white man named Bilaney. Over long-distance telephone, three separate eyewitnesses to the wedding today described it to the Nugget and said they were positive the man they knew as Bilaney and Grey Owl were one and the same. Claims are supported by eyewitnesses to ceremony, says he's English. No matter what they say, Grey Owl was my husband and the father of my daughter, Agnes. Over long-distance telephone from Tamagami, Mrs. Angel Bilaney reiterated her claim to the Nugget today that she is the legal wife of the noted naturalist who died in Prince Albert today. Whether or not she can establish her claim is a moot point with Mrs. Bilaney, but there seems no doubt in the minds of older inhabitants of the Tamagami district that she went through a form of marriage with the man now known as Grey Owl. Several residents of this northern tourist paradise still remember the ceremony, which took place on Bear Island back in 1910. They are positive Bilaney and Grey Owl were one and the same man. It was through an intermediary, because she did not talk very well over the telephone, that Mrs. Bilaney told her story to the Nugget. Grey Owl is my husband, she told the intermediary. And now I am going to see a lawyer and see if at last I cannot prove my claim to his name. The marriage license, she said, was secured through the late Arthur Stevens of Tamagami, who was at that time a justice of the peace. Grey Owl, Mrs. Bilaney claims, is not an Indian, but a full-blooded white man, probably of English descent, who settled in Tamagami in the early days of the district. For 4 years after the marriage, she said, she and her husband lived happily. True, there had been separations while he went trapping and fire ranging, but it was not until 1914, with the outbreak of war, that she bade him a final farewell. He enlisted, she said, early in the war, and did not return to Tamagami until 1925. At that time, Mrs. Bilaney said, Grey Owl wanted to take both her and her daughter, Agnes, 15 years old at the time, away with him. She refused, and since then, all she has heard of him has been through the newspapers. It was a real white man's wedding ceremony, she said. From three eyewitnesses to the wedding, the Nugget secured confirmation of Mrs. Bilaney's story that the service took place. In addition to them being positive that the ceremony had taken place, all were equally positive that the man they knew as Archie Bilaney is the same man whose pictures they have seen publicized from coast to coast as the Indian naturalist, Grey Owl.
In less than a week, the true story of the lean, lonely Englishman became crystal clear. Canada's most famous Indian was really Archibald S. Bilaney, an imaginative son of the British seaside town of Hastings, and certainly as thoroughly English as Robin Hood. As Donald B. Smith, a distinguished Canadian historian, has said, the story of Archie Bilaney's rise to international fame is remarkable. Having led a life without purpose and direction in his 40s, he transformed himself. As Grey Owl, he became a prophet of a vitally important message. He saw one truth clearly, the need to work for the conservation of the environment to preserve Canada's forests and wildlife. He was decades ahead of his time. I'm Kristen Marchand. And for the Opiongo Readers Theatre and our producer, Barry Conway, we wish you a good day and God bless.